Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing at King's Cross Station, two roads south of where Glyndor Michael's heroic afterlife began, one road north of the Sad-Faced Killer's Hotel, a few feet from where the Camden Ripper picked up sex workers, and one road east of the man who mumbled. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Below King's Cross sits a subsurface station which connects the Piccadilly, Northern, Victoria, Circle, Bakerloo, Hammersmith and City and the Metropolitan lines. As one of the busiest tube stations in Europe, more than 150,000 people a day pass through this station. For some, it's part of their commute or a place of work. And for others, it's a place to stay dry and to beg for change. King's Cross is a haven for the homeless. Here you'll see such sad sights as a family of haggard refugees huddled in a rain-sodden doorway, a ragged mess dressed in nothing but a soiled duvet, a brutally honest alcoholic who says,
"Honestly, mate, I just want to get pissed."
And my personal favourite, the red-headed man with the imaginative ploy who once said to me,
"I'm saving up for a boob job, ain't I?"
Every one of them has a tragic tale to tell, whether a life of hardship, struggle, addiction or abuse. Some are criminals, some are heroes, some are lost, and others never want to be found. We all make assumptions in the few seconds it takes to apologetically tap our pockets, or to toss them a few coins simply to feel better about ourselves. But no one really wants to get involved, and that's the problem. On Saturday the 30th of July 1965, at 10:50 a.m, on the westbound Metropolitan line of King's Cross Tube Station, two men from very different worlds met for the very first time. Their interaction was brief, their words exchanged were few, and their lives need never have crossed. And yet for reasons outside of their control, it did. And it changed both of their lives forever. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 168, The Outcast. It was a day which began, for both men, like any other. Lawrence Francis Gwither was a 44-year-old bachelor who lived a good life in a small lodging at nearby 23 Grenfell Square. As a hard-working warehouse porter, he did his job, he paid his taxes, and he kept out of trouble. He was tall and slim, but sturdy, and having suffered with epilepsy since childhood, He'd been unable to enlist as a wartime soldier. But he did his duty for king and country as a messenger. Described as a quiet, thoughtful man who was no bother to anyone, he kept himself to himself. But he wasn't afraid to speak up if he felt that something was wrong. That morning, at 10:30 a.m., Lawrence began his walk to work, heading 1 mile north to King's Cross Station. In contrast, according to his extensive criminal record, John Ritchie was a 42-year-old vagabond with a long history of drunkenness, theft, and violent assault. Having been unable to hold down even the most menial of jobs since his teens, he hadn't worked a day in the last 7 years, and living in a hostel funded by taxpayers, he leached off the system and squandered his benefits on booze. That morning, having already sunk 2 bottles of wine, a quart of cider, and a hip flask of whiskey, being broke, John stumbled onto the Victoria line at Walthamstow. Having arrogantly leapt the barrier and barked abuse at the ticket inspector, this shambling mess rode the tube for free and accosted every commuter for cash. As this scruffy ne'er-do-well staggered about, reeking of piss. As on his shoulder and sleeve, a splash of last night's puke slowly congealed. In court, he couldn't account for how he got there. As being in an alcoholic haze of anger and hate, he hated these bastards and everything about them. And yet the irony was, he needed their money. At 10 a.m, eyewitnesses report seeing John in a tunnel to the side of the ticket hall at King's Cross Tube Station. Sitting slumped, although sloshed, he begged for change by playing his mouth organ. For the station staff, John was a habitual pest. But momentarily lost in his music, he wasn't being abusive. At 10:45 a.m, Lawrence entered the main hall. He purchased a ticket. He went through the turnstile, and he turned right into the tunnel towards the Metropolitan line. A few feet behind him was Eric Mueller Arsman, a 40-year-old planning officer who would state,
"My attention was drawn to a scruffy man playing a mouth organ. As I passed him, he kept playing, but he held out his hand for money. I carried on by, as we all do, and said, 'Not now, another time,' or something like that."
That was the first time that Lawrence and John had met. They didn't speak nor interact. At 10:46 a.m, Lawrence descended the wide stone stairs, turned left onto the westbound Metropolitan Line platform, and stood near the mouth of the tunnel alongside 30 other people.
"The westbound train is about to depart Farringdon and will arrive in 4 minutes.
Eric continued,
"A few minutes later, the man had made his way onto the platform. He was swaying about. I thought he was either off his head or simple. I saw him go to 2 youngsters sitting on a seat."
Being schoolboys and intimidated by the rambling drunk,
"one of them gave him a penny."
But with a penny of the boy's pocket money, not enough to buy booze, John held his hand out for more. Hugh Ferry, a 51-year-old interior decorator, told the court,
"Another man told the mouth organ player he should not be begging."
Others would clarify that what Lawrence had said was,
Do your begging elsewhere.
From the second they had first met, to this final interaction, Lawrence and John's encounter lasted no longer than 3 minutes, and 10 words at best. They had made eye contact. There were no raised voices. Lawrence's words were neither abusive nor threatening. And not wanting to cause a scene, the warehouse porter calmly moved a third of the way down the platform, away from John.
The next westbound Hammersmith and City Line train will be arriving in 2 minutes.
At 10:48 a.m., being 6 hours into his shift manoeuvring the 184 from Whitechapel to Hammersmith, Albert Copeland had left Farringdon on time. Driving the six-car train at 40 miles an hour through the tunnels, although it would slow to 25 miles an hour as it approached the platform, even if the emergency brake is pulled in time, it would still take a few hundred feet for this 200-ton train to come to a stop. Standing 3 feet from the platform edge, Lawrence was minding his own business. And to all who would witness what was about to be unleashed, it seemed as if the scruffy little vagrant was too. As his mouth organ piped a little ditty, and his filthy scratched hand reached out for change,
he turned to the people on the seat and said something, pointing to the man who had just shrugged him off. He was making a nuisance of himself, passing remarks, and he appeared to be under the influence of drink. He seemed to be seeking their sympathy and carried on playing his mouth organ. Then he stopped and pointed to the man who was then standing on the edge of the platform.
To many, it looked as if John was mocking him. But rightly so, Lawrence just ignored him.
The westbound train will be arriving in 1 minute.
Whether what happened was fueled by anger or stupidity, with any rational thoughts clouded by a booze-filled haze, as the shambling mess of a man sidled up the platform, having accosted all and sundry, he stopped behind Lawrence.
He came up behind him, and with his foot near his buttocks, he made a gesture as if he was going to push him.
Lawrence didn't know this, he didn't see it, and he didn't feel it. But it was not a joke.
Please stand back, as the train is now approaching.
At 10:50 a.m., as the westbound train hurtled through the pitch-black tunnel into the blinding light of the platform,
the drunk man gave his buttocks a violent shove
towards the 630-volt electrified track.
It was a heavy kick, and the man lurched forward.
And although, being blessed with quick reflexes, having seen it all happen, Albert had pulled the emergency brake. But it was too late.
I heard him strike the train.
The chance of anyone surviving being struck by a 200-ton train at 25 miles an hour over a 630-volt track would be one chance in a million. But miracles do happen, as this was obviously not Lawrence's day to die. Later, he would tell the court,
I felt a blow in the pit of my back, and this happened just as the train came out of the tunnel. I fell forward and managed to turn. At the same time, I hit the side of the train.
Having been kicked a split second too late, he had missed being smacked by the roaring train by inches, or falling onto the track underneath the train's wheels. Instead, the right-hand side of his body hit the motorman's cab, and having bounced off the window, Lawrence was thrown back onto the platform.
I don't know what happened, but I gathered my senses.
And as Albert brought the tube train to a standstill, he was amazed not only to see that Lawrence was alive, but still standing. The only injuries to his body were a bruise to his palm, a cut to his little finger, and a ripped fingernail. With John Ritchie attempting to flee, the train driver and two witnesses grabbed him by the sleeve and frog-marched the stinky reprobate to the station inspector's office in the ticket hall. Kicking up a fuss and reeking of whiskey as he unleashed the foulest of language, when Lawrence told PC Dugdale,
"This man tried to kill me."
John admitted,
"Yeah, I did it. And I'll f***ing do a proper job if I go down for this. I'll kill the c***. He's not going to touch me up."
An alleged sexual assault that no one had seen. John Ritchie was taken to the Caledonian Road police station and charged with causing actual bodily harm. Tried at Clerkenwell Magistrates Court, the jury heard of his history as one of life's wastrels. Described as a scoundrel, a rogue, and a vagabond, John Ritchie was nothing more than a recalcitrant and a drunk. Since the age of 19, he had spent 9 years, 10 months, and 8 days of his 42 years in prison for a never-ending catalogue of crimes, such as robbery, theft, burglary, and assaulting 3 policemen. Throughout his life, repeated attempts were made to improve his behaviour. With 3 years spent in corrective training and 6 months in a psychiatric hospital. But as a remorseless drunk who flouted bail and often broke probation, it was clear that he didn't care and was unwilling to change his ways. With the magistrate feeling that a charge of actual bodily harm was a sentence too lenient given what could have happened, the case was escalated to the Old Bailey on the charge of attempted murder. And that was it. There was nothing else to say. The evidence was watertight. The witnesses were clear. And although drunk at the time of the attack, John Ritchie would not dispute these events. The prosecution had put before the jury every reprehensible thing he had ever done in his life to paint him as a leech on society, which he would agree that he was. But he also felt that unfairly, this was only one side of his life story, and that there was more to him than just a criminal record. His was a history of hardship. And maybe, if he appealed to a sympathetic ear, he wouldn't go to prison for life. In a letter to the Court of Appeal, John wrote,
"I've no wish to minimise the charges against me. It was a wrong and foolish act, and I'm sincerely sorry. However, I feel that my case was badly defended, and the court was not informed as to my actual physical state at the time."
This was what the jury did not hear. John Ritchie was born on the 30th of April 1922 in Paisley, Scotland. As the second eldest of 8 siblings, in a small cramped lodging, where every week they struggled to make ends meet. When asked, John's memory of his childhood was vague. As maybe he couldn't recall, or maybe he had chosen to forget. What he could remember was that his father was an angry, abusive drinker who was handy with his fists. Until the age of 14, John was educated at Abercorn Public School in Paisley, where he'd learned to read and write. As a short, slightly scrawny kid, although a chatty little fella, he gained a reputation as a bit of a scrapper. As the bigger bullies picked on this feisty lad at school, and then again, it would happen at home. Whether he was abandoned or fled in fear, being barely into his teens, he would lose almost all contact with his family. As far as he knew, his siblings had scattered. His mother had died of cancer. And his father was alive 11 years ago. Although, by now, it was likely that he had drunk himself to death. His first job was as a newspaper boy in Glasgow, making a pittance for long hours standing in the cold and wet. Determined to earn his own money and to stand on his own two feet, he slogged his guts out for 2 years and did himself proud. By 1938, age 16, he was training as an apprentice car mechanic. He was learning a trade. He lived in a rented lodging. He had food in his belly and a bright future ahead. Life was going well for John, until the world changed everything. In August 1939, under orders to fight for king and country, 17-year-old John Ritchie was conscripted to fight as a rifleman in the Cameronian Rifles, seeing active service in the Middle East, Sicily and Italy. He was just a small, frightened kid, sent off to fight, to kill, and possibly to die in a foreign land of unspeakable horrors. Images it would be impossible to scrub from his memory once the blood had etched into his brain. With no outlet for his trauma, he drank. And the more death he saw, the more he drank. Until getting wasted was the only way to survive the moments when his eyes were open. Deep down, he was a good lad. And some say decent when he was sober. But when he drank, the drink unleashed his demons. On the 14th of May 1943 and the 4th of January 1946, Private John Ritchie was court-martialed for 2 cases of drunkenness and desertion and was sentenced to a total of 14 months in prison. During his desertion, he turned to crime. Being bound over for 3 years for robbery with violence, 3 months hard labour for stealing cigarettes, and 6 months for burglary and theft. He was discharged with ignominy from the Cameronian Rifles, making him ineligible for veterans' benefits. Distanced from his family, traumatized by the war, and denied the most basic of income he was owed, alcohol became his way to cope. With nothing of value in his life, John the Veteran became John the Vagrant. A shambling mess who drifted from town to town, causing a nuisance. His crimes were minor. March 48, Marylebone, 3 months for stealing 29 shillings. September 48, Clerkenwell. 7 days for theft of an egg cup in a gravy boat. August 49, Glasgow. 90 days for drink driving. October 49, Glasgow. 3 months for the theft of cigarettes. May 50, Bow Street, assaulting a policeman. And June 50, 3 months for drink driving. On paper, when read out to a jury, this brief passage from his lengthy criminal record makes him seem like a selfish, remorseless thief. Only he wasn't. He was an addict. And he was trying to fight it. In 1951, as he had done many times before, John battled his demons and sobered up. From January 51 to July 52, he worked for 8 months as a packer at Cowan de Groot in Holborn and 11 months as a machine operator at Babcox and Wilcox nearby. He was sober, polite, prompt, and well-liked. After a decade in the wilderness, he had finally got his life back on track. Only of all his battles, drink was the most difficult demon to slay. In July 1952, after his fourth conviction for drink driving, John was sentenced to 6 months at Longgrove Mental Hospital, where he would be detoxed under strict medical supervision. Every day was pain, and every night he screamed, as his torturous demons refused to let his addled brain be free. But he did it, and he was clean. In November 1952, he had found work as a handyman at Frederick Simmons in Holborn. And again, he got his life back on track. But as so often happens, having kept his criminal record a secret, as nobody wants to hire an ex-con, he lost his job, his lodging, and gripped with depression, he went back to the booze. His life continued this way through the 1950s and into the 1960s. He was in and out of prison, on and off of jobs, and back and forth from the bottle. Some days he was clean, other days he was sloshed. Some weeks he had a roof over his head, and others he slept shivering in a rain-soaked doorway. In prison, at least he was fed and dry. But regardless of his crimes, he was always a prisoner of his own body. From 1953 to 58, he barely worked a few weeks or few days as a packer in a factory. And being sacked from his last job as a kitchen porter in Margate, for the rest of his life, he would live off benefits of £4.17 a week, which he squandered on drink. News which would only have rankled any taxpaying jury. On the 11th of December 1964, John was released from HMP Dartmoor. He had been unemployed for 7 years, a prisoner for 10, homeless for 15, and he had been battling alcoholism for almost a quarter of a century. With a criminal record stretching over 4 pages, he was known to every pub or off license, constable or court, and his rap sheet listed him as a vagabond, a rogue, and a scoundrel. In short, John Ritchie was dirt. One month after his release, John was living in a halfway house at 99 Church Hill in Walthamstow. A depressing little bedsit in a hostel crammed full of sex pests, druggies, and drunks. He had no job, no roots, no friends. And with those old familiar demons calling his name, he knew that he needed help. John would state,
"As I have no wish to spend the rest of my life in prison, I tried to do something constructive to effect a cure. I walked into St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington. The best they could do for me was to see a psychiatrist next week."
And seeing the seriousness of his sickness,
"I was recommended hospitalisation."
A possible cure for his illness was in sight.
"I was fixed an appointment for the 9th of February 1965. And in the interval, I truly tried to do without alcohol. But the compulsion was too strong."
As it's easier to stay sober on a ward, but almost impossible when you're stuck inside a dingy, depressing bedsit. On Wednesday the 27th of January 1965, he contacted the probation service, who tried to intervene. As seeing his pain and desperation to get clean, they knew that if he got back on the booze, he would go back to prison. Somehow, it worked. That day, John received his confirmation. On Monday, the 1st of February 1965, 1 week earlier, he would be committed to St. Bernard's Psychiatric Hospital to treat his alcoholism. This was John's moment to kick his addiction forever. All he had to do was to wait out the weekend without touching the booze.
"I was arrested that night for drink and bailed when sober. I failed to appear in court. I was arrested again and fined, arrested again and bailed out. And I carried on like this in an alcoholic haze."
On Saturday the 30th of January 1965, at 10:45 a.m, as John Ritchie played his mouth organ to soothe his pain, beside the westbound Metropolitan Line tube. Having been drunk, tired, and hungry for 3 days, having sunk 2 bottles of wine, a quart of cider, and a hip flask of whiskey that morning alone, he had no memory of how he got there, and having fallen off the wagon, he had lost his one shot at sobriety. And as every person passed him, no one had any idea about his past or his struggles. As to them, he was just a dirty drunk. Having been dragged by a baying mob to the station inspector's office at King's Cross, as 5 witnesses spoke of how he'd kicked Lawrence Gwither into the path of a moving train, it was the drink who spoke up for John Ritchie.
"This man tried to kill me. Yeah, I did it. And I'll do a proper job if I go down for this. I'll kill the c-."
And with that, his fate was sealed. Taken to the Caledonian Road police station, he was charged with ABH and was held at Brixton Prison. When his case was heard at Clerkenwell, the jury would learn every bad deed he had done, but not the context for his drinking and his aggression. Escalated to the Old Bailey, on the 11th of March 1965, John Ritchie was tried on the more serious charge of attempted murder, which, if found guilty, would warrant a life behind bars. Again, his history was ignored, and he was sentenced to 5 years for ABH. Hoping to hear a sympathetic ear, he sent a handwritten letter to the Court of Appeal, imploring,
"I truly state that, although I was provoked into an assault, had I been in the right mind, reason would have controlled my impulsive emotions. That, at the time, through continual drinking, lack of food and sleep, I was in a poor state, both mentally and physically. Considering these facts, my lords, I consider the present sentence of 5 years is severe, and I appeal for leniency."
His appeal was rejected, and he was sent to Wandsworth Prison. In March 1987, Lawrence Squither died in Hendon at the age of 67. After his release, John Ritchie's whereabouts remain unknown.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
That's better. Good.
Done. Scrunching up my list of my list of what people's voices are going to be in that episode, because I realised there was lots of voices and I had to write down. And originally it was John was going to be Scottish because he comes from Scotland, or Kai the New Haggis, things like that. And it's a voice I should be able to do, given the fact that I'm half Scottish. But I could, for some reason, I couldn't do it today, and I struggled and struggled. And it just sounded really shit. Sometimes there's words that you say and it just sounds shit. You just say the words and it just goes, doesn't sound, you're like, oh, Hawkeye the New. Yeah, fine, that's stereotypical Scottish. We get away with that if you're in the 1980s and you want to wear one of those Jimmy wigs and things like that. But if you want to put it in a podcast and try and make it work, it's not going to work. So in the end, I came across, and because I'd already got one of the characters who was a little bit Cockney, Lawrence, I put him as a little bit Cockney. I had to think of what John's voice was going to be. In the end, I opted for because he'd lived in London for quite a long time. I thought, you know what, let's put a little bit of a London twang on it. So there we go. So I made him a little bit South London, but not extremely South London. So there we go. Oh, how is everyone doing? Are we all good? Are we all well? I'm going to move my soundproofing thingy, hopefully without pulling out the thingy. This is all very technical, isn't it? Open a window. I might not make a cup of tea, although I might. I don't know. I'm in a real tears at the moment. As you can tell, I don't sound good. Not sounding good at all. So we can now play a game of, does he have COVID or does he not have COVID? That's the thing. So I went out last week. Oh, well, sorry, to new people, welcome to Extra Mile. This is the unedited, unscripted bit. I keep forgetting to do this. We're going to do a little quiz in a bit. I'm going to give you loads of information about kind of this case as well. But then we have a bit of a waffle at the start. And people enjoy the waffle, which is why I do it. So, yeah, COVID or not COVID. I've been being safe for 2 years. I'm fully vaccinated and fully boosted. I wear my mask. I isolate properly. I wash my hands properly. unlike most people who can't be bothered because they think that the pandemic is over. I was invited out to a mate's do last week. It was in a pub. I was unsure. They said, don't worry, it's fine. We're in a separate room out back. You can't get access to the room unless you're in the room. There's only 10 of us there who you know. And it was a big enough room that we could isolate properly. So I thought, yeah, it's fine. A couple of days later, I started feeling a bit rough. Did a test, got a positive COVID thing back. My first ever positive. I messaged two friends who were there. They reported positive as well. And I was like, oh, shit. And then I was waiting and I was like, I've been kind of cold-like symptoms and a sore throat all week. And I was like, everyone, is this COVID or not? And they were like, oh, well, that's how it started for us. Like, I was like, because I don't have a fever. I just have a sore throat and a cold. So maybe it's just a cold because I haven't had a cold in a year. So maybe my body wants to have a cold or needs to have a cold. And it's summer as well. It's a change in seasons. This is when you kind of get colds anyway. And they went, oh, this is when it all kicks off. You're like, oh, you're going to get all shivery and you're going to get brain fog and you're going to get the massive headaches, which last for about a couple of days and you're going to be knocked out for a couple of weeks and it's going to be horrible. Nothing. This is it. I've had my Lemsip every day and my Jakemans, which have been great. Those little sweets that you can get, the old-fashioned sweets with the menthol inside, really good. They help me through the night. But all I've had is like a bit of a tickly throat and a bit of a chesty cough. And that's it. So I don't know if I've got COVID. And I would love to go into town and get one of those tests. You know, you can get the... I'm sure everyone on here is going, oh, get your PCR test. Miss, you can order a PCR set test and it turns up at your house, doesn't it? I live on a boat that's floating around, which means my PCR test is going to turn up in Soho, which is where my PO box is, which is at least an hour's journey away. And I can only get in there with my bike, which is currently smashed up still because of my accident. So, so I can't get a PCR test and I'm isolating for 11 days. I've still got a couple more days to go now. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I have COVID or not. It doesn't feel like it. If it is, it's own brand COVID. It's the cheapo shite. I hope it isn't. I think it's just a cold. It feels like a cold. I'm not, like, even my SATs, like, I've got a smartwatch, and I know they're not 100% accurate, but my blood oxygen level's still good. I'm still, it dipped down to 96 very briefly, but it's still back up to 99, which is where it always is. So, yeah. Anyway, so that was exciting. So COVID or not COVID, I don't know. Just want to say thank you to two new Patreon supporters who are Darren Hambley and Jason Owen. Thank you to both of you. Hope you're getting all the new goodies. If you haven't subscribed to Patreon, there's lots of goodies in there. Obviously, I do the weekly video. I've started to make this the place where all of my secret Murdermile minisodes, they go up there first, and people seem to be enjoying that. So that's nice because it takes me bloody ages to make those. You also get all the crime scene photos that I don't share anywhere else. So you get all the secret stuff. So even though it's only £2 a month, it's a bargain. And what can you buy for £2 in this era? You can't even buy like half a coffee. Or you're lucky. You're almost lucky in London if you could buy one of these 500ml Diet Cokes. Because this one, oh, actually, well, full fat coke now, because the sugar tax has gone, that's gone up to a ridiculous amount. Even though I wouldn't drink that because it's just too much sugar. Anyway, let's do some quiz questions. Don't forget, as always, I might probably ball these up. You might have noticed with last week's episode, some questions you couldn't answer. That's because I edited them out of the episode. But I don't edit extra mile, so I'm not going to go back in and edit these out of the extra mile because it's not worth the time. I just put a caveat in there. I'm yet to edit this episode, which means things may go missing. Right, questions. Question number one. What was John described as in court? There were three words that they used to describe him. What were they? Question number two. Which, everything's in threes today, which three physical items, not money, do we know that John stole in the first of his criminal charges? So three specific items. One of them makes sense. The other two are a little bit weird. Question number three. What was John's first job? Question number four. Which army did he serve in? Question five. Which part of London was his hostel in? PCAG. I wonder if he went to the hostel. Little joke for you there.
I bet he did. Question number six. Who was the PC who arrested John? So who was the police constable who arrested John? Question seven. Where was the train heading to that day? So the train that hit Lawrence, where was it heading to? Question eight. This is a hard one, I think. What was the number of the train? Question nine. How many cars/carriages did the train comprise of? And question 10. How many volts were in the electrified track? Ooh, I've got burpees. So let's have a look. Oh, dear. Amazing I made it through that record without coughing. There was some coughing and some burping as well because I'm on Diet Coke. And you shouldn't really record a podcast on Diet Coke because it makes you very burpy. So yeah, as we know, he was conscripted August 1939, so the start of World War II. I can't say which army because that's one of the questions. He was a rifleman. He seemed to be doing relatively well until kind of for the first 2 years. I say relatively well. He'd already started drinking by that point. But as mentioned, he was court-martialed twice for drunkenness. And they say offences of a military nature, which I worked out was desertion when I looked into his court record. His military record. His first offence, he was sentenced to 168 days, and then, which is roughly 5 and a bit months, and then 9 months for detention after that. Which meant, but because he'd already... I'm going to go through all of his offences now, because obviously in this story I skipped a lot of them, just because what you don't want is... He did this, he did that, he did that. I mean... COVID. So let's have a look at his criminal history. 4th of February 1941, he was charged with robbery at the Central Criminal Court, so that's the Old Bailey. He was fined £5 and bound over for 3 years for receiving a stolen identity card. Don't worry, that is not one of the answers to the questions because I didn't read that out in the episode. After that, he was in Southwold in Suffolk. So he'd gone to London, then he moved to Southwold, where he served 6 months and 3 months hard labour for stealing from a shop. Then after that, May 1947 at Greenock, so that's northwest of Glasgow. So you can see that he very much is a drifter. You can learn more. He tells little about his life, but you can learn a lot about his life by his criminal record. He served 6 months in prison for theft, for housebreaking, for stealing jewellery and money. Don't worry, that's not part of the quiz question. I didn't put it in the episode. 18th of March 1946 at Marylebone, so back in London. 3 months for stealing 29 shillings from a house. Again, with the quiz question, I said not including money. 13th of March 1948 at Clerkenwell. 7 days in prison for stealing and a. They're the two things that you need to find. 6th of August 1949 at Glasgow Sheriff's Office. So he's back up in Glasgow now. 90 days in prison for theft, failing to stop after an accident, dangerous driving, driving while drunk, no licence and no insurance. October 1949, 3 months in Glasgow, again for attempted theft, we don't know what for. May 1950, £5 fine at Bow Street, so back in London, for the assault of a policeman. 30th of June 1950, Bow Street again, 6 months in prison for driving disqualified. He's been disqualified from driving for 5 years. 40 shilling fine. Apparently, he took a vehicle without consent, i.e., theft of a motor vehicle, drunk and dangerous driving. And then that's when he tries to get himself back on track. He's released from prison. He wants to stop drinking. He gets a job at Messrs. Cowan de Groot and Babcocks and Wilcox. These were all over in Holborn area. So he's a packer and a machine operator. And he seems to be doing that for like a year and a half. He's doing all right. He's kind of on track. But then now everything starts going downhill again. 30th of April 1952, County of London Sessions, £10 fine, disqualified for driving for 1 year, which is ironic because he's already been disqualified for 5 years. And that was only in 1950. I love it when you see these when the courts have to go through this process and they go, well, we have to charge you with this, even though it's like when a child is 14 years old and he steals a car and crashes it and they disqualify him for 2 years, and you go, but he's 14 now, and then you're disqualifying him until he gets to 16, and then only then can he legally drive a car, and he's a little shit anyway, he's not going to abide by your rules. But they have to tick the boxes, don't they? They have to go, well, we have to charge you with this, and it's like, oh, you bullshit. 22nd of July 1952, so Thames Magistrates Court, who's back in London, 2 years probation, they were trying to play lenient with him on this time, conditional for 6 months, and he was going to spend 6 months at Longgrove Mental Hospital. Originally, his charge for that was just tampering with a car, but they decided by this point, because he was a drunk and lots of drink driving, they need to sort out his drinking. It seemed to work. He was there for about 6 months. That's when he got a job as a handyman back over at Holborn Viaduct. He seems to congregate back to Holborn. Holborn is kind of just outside Covent Garden. So it's just, we've covered a little bit of Holborn before, but it is just slightly out. March 1953, County of London again, 9 months in prison, disqualified from driving for 10 years. This is ironic because he's already been disqualified for 5 years and 1 year, and this was only about 3 or 4 years ago, for car theft, dangerous driving and breach of probation. I wonder if he'll consider the fact that he's been disqualified from driving for 10 years and he won't for another 10 years. I doubt it. He got a job as a packer at Bung Brothers. What a name. E9, so it's over in the East End. He did that for a couple of months. With his work record, it's getting less and less and less every time. It starts off with like 6 months, it starts off with a couple of years, then it's a couple of months, then it gets down to weeks, in some cases days. May 1954, he was sent off for, inverted commas, corrective training, following a dangerous drink driving. Oh, there we go again, drink driving. And he was there, and he got a job as a packer at the Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents, which is kind of ironic given the fact that he was done for drink driving. After that, he came out. He managed to get a job again as a packer at Angel & Son in Stepney. Unfortunately, he was only there for barely a month. After that, more criminal convictions. Bow Street for begging. Back at Bow Street in early 57, a month in prison, suspected of loitering with intent and to commit a felony. November 1957, Bow Street, 3 months served for begging in a public place and assault on a police officer, again. 5th of March 1958, County of London, 4 months in prison, loitering with intent and begging. And on his criminal sheet, they regard him as an incorrigible rogue and a vagabond. This is listed on his criminal record. And he also served another day in February 1958 at Clerkenwell for begging. As 1 day's detention, so he was just in a police cell on that day. Work-wise, he attempted again at this point, 1958, to get himself clean. He got a job as a packer at Sweet and Maxwell in October 1958, but that was just 3 weeks. The following summer, that was his final job as a kitchen hand at the Haven Hotel in Margate. That was his last ever job, and he lasted for what appears to be one season, so the summer. September 1959, that was the end of it. He was occasionally odd jobs here and there, but none that were ever listed. He's living off national assistance. He's unemployed. He gets £4.17 per week on benefits, and he's... job description, he's actually described on it as an alcoholic, so they don't list him as having a job. After that, again, just more criminal records. December 1959 at Stratford, so East London, fined £20 and 2 months in prison, and had to pay £5.50 costs, suspected of loitering with intent. April 60, Bournemouth on the south coast, fined £3 for stealing a library book. 11th of April 60, again, Bournemouth, 7 days for begging. Again, in May, Bournemouth, 1 month for begging. June 1960, over at Torquay. So he's moved to the south coast, but the southwest now. 7 months consecutively for assault on another policeman, drunk and disorderly. December, back in London, 9 months in prison. Again, listed as an incorrigible rogue, suspected of loitering with intent to steal cars. June 1961, it goes on. Brighton. 7 months consecutively for drunken disorder and Assault on a Policeman, another one. Clerkenwell, April 62, 2 months, £1, a £3 bail for begging and drunk. September 62, another day in prison for begging, again described as an incorrigible rogue. That's fine. 18th of February, oh, my birthday. 1963, not my birthday. Lambeth Magistrates Court, so South London. 6 months in prison for stealing a chicken and one piece of meat from a shop worth 15 shillings and one pence. What a lovely detail. 11th of July 1963, Exeter. So again he's moved. Fined £3 for being drunk and incapable. And then his final one, 17th of September 1963, 2 years in prison at Devon for housebreaking and stealing. Five cases of that. And he was released 11th of December 1964. So that is 6 weeks before he was arrested for the attempted murder of Lawrence Squither. I'll read you his letter of appeal. I won't do it in a voice. I'll just do it. This is his exact words. So, my lords, I have no wish to minimise the charges against me. It was a wrong and foolish act to commit. I am sincerely sorry that it occurred at all. However, I feel that my case was badly defended and that the court has not been informed of my actual physical state at the time or my history of alcoholism. All of my past convictions have been caused through drink or by means of drink. Since I was last released from prison on the 11th of December 1964, where I tried unsuccessfully to get treatment for this affliction, I started to drink heavy again. As I have no wish to spend the rest of my life in and out of prison, I tried to do something constructive in effecting a cure. I walked into St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington, seeking help. The best they could do for me was to offer an appointment the following week at the psychiatric department. I attended and after the interview was recommended hospitalisation. A further appointment was fixed for the 9th of February with a view to being admitted to St. Bernard's. In the interval, I truly tried to do without alcohol, but the compulsion was too strong. I sought help and advice where I could. A Mr. Smith of City Road, that was one of the alcohol advisory councils that he was going to, was very helpful and understanding. I tried the probation service on Borough High Street, and in desperation, Mr. Sweeney of Bow Street probation officer was amazed that I could not be admitted immediately. He asked me to try and stick it out until the Monday, it being Friday, I think, until he saw what could be done. So he was the guy who actually called them up and was like, hey, you need to get this guy in ASAP, not wait. I was arrested that night for drink and bailed out when sober. I failed to appear in court. I was arrested again and fined, which I still owe. I was arrested again, bailed out when sober. These arrests were made at different stations. And so I carried on in an alcoholic haze until I was arrested on the 30th of January on this charge. I truly state that although I was provoked into this assault, had I been of the right mind, reason would have controlled impulsive emotions. And at that time, through continual drinking, lack of food and sleep, I was in a poor state both mentally and physically. Considering these facts, my lords, I consider the present sentence of 5 years is severe and appeal for leniency. John Ritchie. So there we go. There's that. I might do a little bit of Lawrence's statements. I did, originally when I was writing this, I started using Lawrence's statements, and then I decided that by using his statements too early in the episode, it gives away the idea that he survived. So I wanted you to think that he was going to get murdered and killed, but he doesn't. He survives. So I ended up not using his statements as much as I wanted to. But his were. I thought that was a policeman walking past there, and it's just someone who looks almost like a policeman. Lawrence would state, I noticed a man in the tunnel leading to the entrance. He was playing a mouth organ. As I waited on the platform for my train, as I was waiting, the man came onto the platform and went up to two young men sitting on a seat, and one of them gave him a penny. That man kept holding out his hand for the money, and I said to him, don't do that, mate, that's begging. I also told him that he should place a cap on the ground for money to put it in. I was waiting for the next train near the tunnel, which the train would have come out to enter the platform, I was standing about 3 feet away from the edge of the platform when I felt a blow in the pit of my back, and this happened just as the train came out of the tunnel. I fell forward and managed to turn. At the same time, I hit the side of the train. The two carriages passed me when I fell. My right-hand side of my body hit the side of the carriage, and my hand also. I don't know what happened next, but when I gathered my senses, I noticed that the man who had been playing the mouth organ was standing at the back of the platform, immediately behind me when I was pushed. I went back to this man, and another man came up and said that he had seen what had happened. The driver of the train came up, and as did some other officials. We were all then taken to an office, and the police were sent for. The injuries caused by hitting the train are worse on my right hand. The small finger on my hand has a cut on the back. The nail is torn and the palm appears to be bruised. I understand that this man suggested that the reason he did this to me was because I indecently assaulted him by touching his private parts. This I stoutly deny. All that took place prior to this incident is exactly what I have described, which is what everyone else describes as well. There you go. There you go. I'll tell you what, I'll do some of the questions. oh, coffee McCough face. Right, let's do the questions and then I can have a good cough afterwards. Oh, I haven't got a cake or anything. I'm still on my diet, still being good. Haven't broken. Can't get rid of the final bit. It's the last bit now. The last bit of flab. And it's the bit that won't shift. Bastard. Anyway, right, quiz questions. Question number one. How was John described in court? Three words there. I gave you one of them briefly in there. He was described as a scoundrel, a rogue, and a vagabond. Question two. Which three items, not money, do we know that he stole in his first criminal charges? They were cigarettes, an egg cup, and a gravy boat. All the essentials. Question number three. What was John's first job? He was a newspaper boy. Question four. Which army did he serve in? It was the Cameronian Rifles. Question five. Which part of London was his hostel in? It was Walthamstow. Question six. Who was the PC who arrested John? His name was PC Dugdale. Question seven. Where was the train heading to? It was going to Hammersmith. Question eight. Hard one. What was the name of the train? It was the 184. Question nine. How many cars or carriages did the train comprise of? It was six. And how many volts were in the electric track? It was 630. So there you go. There you go. That's that done. Oh, I'm looking forward to having my Jakemans now. They really have been a benefit. They're very good. You get like 15, 20 in a pack or whatever, and they're just those old style. I think in the old days they would have been made with tar or some shit like that. But now it's just like, what's in them? It's an old-fashioned menthol sweet. The original and famous throat and chest soothing menthol sweet. There we go. Made of the finest ingredients. What are they made of? Glucose, syrup, sugar, menthol, aniseed oil, eucalyptus, and some colour. There we go. All good, but it does the trick. Gets me through the night. Right, that's me done. Hope you enjoyed that. Hopefully I'll be less croaky next week. And just to say, I have my new videos coming out every week. So if you want to, you can go to the YouTube channel. There's lots of old videos on there, new videos, and hopefully something exciting coming this autumn. Oh, exciting. So have yourself a good week. Thank you for supporting the show. Stay safe, stay healthy. Be good, everyone. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince.
I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.